This is Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlohm. 65 million years ago, at the end of the Cretaceous period, a massive asteroid impacted Earth and wiped out a huge percentage of life on Earth, including the dinosaurs. Since the 1980s, the threat of extraterrestrial impact has been a major focus for planetary scientists, trying to make sure that we survey the skies for asteroids and comets that pose a potential threat, while engineers and physicists have grappled with the problem of what we could actually do to deflect a potential impactor. Later in the program, we'll talk to physicist Megan Bruxial from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory about our latest plan called HAMMER, Hypervelocity Asteroid Mitigation Mission for Emergency Response. And we'll visit with asteroid orbit expert Paul Chodas from the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena as he explains how we go about determining which asteroids actually pose a threat. But first, we interviewed Lindley Johnson. He's NASA's top official responsible for dealing with the threat posed by NEOs, near-Earth objects. He even has the title of Planetary Defense Officer at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Lindley Johnson, welcome to Blue Dot.
Oh, thank you. I'm very glad to be talking with you.
I saw that you have a background in the Air Force, and I always like to find out first about, you know, how people get to where they are now. Could you tell us a bit about your Air Force career?
Well, yes, I was an Air Force ROTC when I went to the University of Kansas. And so I graduated from commission in the Air Force as a second lieutenant and spent 23 years in various space-related activities in the Air Force.
What were some, if you can talk about them, what were some of the space-related activities?
Well, I started off as a orbital analyst in Cheyenne Mountain, tracking all the satellites and debris in Earth orbit. So that is a little bit of a microcosm of what I do today. It's now I'm tracking debris in the solar system.
Did you ever track Santa?
Well, actually, being in Cheyenne Mountain, that's one of the things we did every Christmas. We were part of NORAD, and we tracked Santa.
I always thought that was just the most wonderful thing.
Yeah, it was fun.
Well, how did you first get interested in the hazards that near-Earth objects, asteroids, present to impacting the Earth? When did that first catch your interest, and when did you first get involved with that?
Well, I've always been interested in the solar system. When I was in astronomy at KU, I was more on the solar system astronomy side of things, whereas my professor was into intergalactic Cepheid variables, I think, was his specialty. My most direct interest started when I was at Phillips Laboratory in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and Tom Garrels at the University of Arizona came up and talked to us about what he was doing and wanting to use CCDs to detect and track asteroids, and we were working on using CCDs for space surveillance purposes back then. So it was kind of a partnership that made a lot of sense. And at that time I said, yeah, you know, this is a area that requires some attention, and I should look about getting involved in that.
Yeah, CCDs, that's charge coupled devices, as I recall. And so that's like the first iteration of using digital or electronic technology, at least.
Digitizing imagery so it could be computer processed, yes.
Instead of just taking films. Well, let's talk about the near-Earth asteroid threat. Can you just give us an overview of the amount of objects that are in orbits that are near Earth's orbit, and give us an overview of what we know about that threat right now?
Well, the first thing to realize that on human lifetime scales, an impact by an asteroid of any size is extremely rare. In fact, maybe once a century or so is there an impact that we should really worry about. When one happens of significance, it can be very devastating, especially for the local area. But there are, thousands, literally thousands of objects out there that are in orbits that can cross Earth's orbit. It's the debris left over from the formation of the solar system. And these are objects that cross Earth's orbit. They represent a hazard of impacting the Earth, and therefore, now that we have the technology to detect and track them and determine where there are possible impacts, there are also a natural disaster that could be prevented if we were to find out about it far enough ahead of time, and we now have the technology to do something about it.
Yeah, one of my favorite sayings is that, you know, the dinosaurs didn't have a space program, which is why they went extinct.
Right, and I have a T-shirt now that says, "Asteroids are nature's way of asking how's that space program going."
Yes, and you know that we're kind of being a little flippant about it, but we shouldn't be, because even though it's a low probability event in any given lifetime, or even over the course of centuries, of course, you know, we haven't had a major asteroid impact during historical times that I can think of, that's disrupted a city or anything like that. But if one does happen, you know, the implications of that are immense. Can you just kind of talk to the low probability versus the high impact, if you will, scale?
Although we haven't had an impact that in recent history that has caused significant damage to a populated area, the Tunguska impact in 1908, which luckily came down in a very remote area of the Siberian forest, devastated an area of some 800 square miles or so. And were that to occur near a population center today, it would be a disaster on the scale, a larger scale than anything that we've had to deal with in the United States. So it is a very high consequence, although an extremely rare event. And I need to say that although none of the some 18,000 now near-Earth asteroids that we are tracking with our program at NASA are predicted to impact in the next 100 years or so. We project the orbits out as much as 100 years into the future. That represents only about a third of the estimated population of asteroids that are 150 meters or larger in size. And so we only know a 30%, 33% or so of the objects that are out there that could do significant damage, devastate a metropolitan area were they to impact.
So if I get that right, there's 2/3 of the objects that could do significant damage are unknown to us?
That's our current estimate on the population, that we only know about a third of those out there that could devastate a regional area.
You know, I remember when I first became really interested in this in the early 90s, becoming acquainted with Gene and Carolyn Shoemaker. I remember the saying was that, you know, the amount of people that are actually searching for these objects, you know, is about the number of people working in a McDonald's restaurant. Could you compare that back then to where are we now compared to that?
Well, we have a significantly larger number of people that are working on it now. Back then, there were maybe one or two small search teams working on it. NASA now funds about four major search projects. In other words, projects that run at least one and sometimes up to three ground-based telescopes dedicated to search and discovery of near-Earth asteroids. Plus, we have one space-based activity now. We've taken over the Wide Area Infrared Survey Explorer at JPL and made it a full-time asteroid detection and characterization asset now. So there are significantly more people involved across the endeavor now. I'd say we're probably up to about 150 to 200 folks that are involved, at least part-time, in our near-Earth object observations program now.
And things have become a lot more automated, haven't they?
Well, yes, that's true. From back in the days when they were taking photo plates and using blink comparators, you know, underneath the dual microscopes too. Now it is all computer. The images are computer processed to detect moving objects in the image frames, comparing one time step to another. And then those potential detections are presented to a human operator to quality check and confirm that, yes, indeed, this is probably a asteroid candidate before those observations are then sent to the Minor Planet Center. But I'd also say that only about a tenth of the detections that are made of asteroids, maybe even actually a little less than that, of asteroid detections are near-Earth objects. By far, the majority of them are asteroids that are still in the main belt between Mars and Jupiter. So it's a sorting process to get down to the ones that are of potential hazardous interest.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll finish our interview with Lindley Johnson, Planetary Defense Officer at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's continue our interview with NASA's Chief Planetary Defense Officer, Lindley Johnson. And then we'll hear a conversation with Paul Chodas from the Jet Propulsion Lab. He's an expert on the orbits of objects that pose a threat to Earth. Well, as I mentioned at the top, you are the head of the Planetary Defense Coordination Office. And I'm sure that most of our listeners aren't aware that we even had such a thing. Could you tell us about how that came about and what exactly coordination means? What other agencies or what other parts of NASA are you in charge of coordinating?
Right. Well, NASA has had a near-Earth object observations program for many years. The origins of it started in 1998 when we committed to Congress that we would find the 1 kilometer and larger near-Earth asteroids. And the program is successfully accomplished that objective back about 8 years ago. Now we crossed the threshold of having found at least 90% of the 1 kilometer and larger, and now we're working on the smaller population. The Planetary Defense Coordination Office, its origins go quite a ways back. Some early involvement I had suggested that there needed to be a national coordination effort for this. More recently, though, a planetary defense ad hoc task force was set up by the NASA Advisory Committee that advises the administrator on NASA activities. And one of the things that it recommended was that NASA set up a office that reported to headquarters, that coordinated efforts across not only NASA, but within the U.S. government and cooperated with international efforts for near-Earth object detection, tracking, and potential activities for mitigation. Chelyabinsk event, though, in 2013, where a 20-meter asteroid came in over Russia, really kind of brought things to a head and increased the interest and concern about this hazard. And that led to increases in our funding here at NASA for near-Earth object detection and tracking, and in turn, the establishment of the Planetary Defense Coordination Office here at NASA. And so our job is to coordinate, oversee, and fund not only NASA efforts, NASA-funded projects, but activities across the U.S. government and work with our international counterparts.
And how did you fare in the current budget? Is the program being funded fully as far as that goes?
Yes, we have enjoyed good support from Congress and appropriations. FY18 budget, fiscal year 18 budget, which is finally just recently passed, gives us a $66 million budget for not only NEO detection, tracking, and characterization, but also the start of our first in-space mitigation demonstration, asteroid deflection demonstration with the double asteroid redirect test. So starting our more in-depth efforts as far as what are we going to do about one asteroid on an impact trajectory with Earth if we find one.
Well, we're about out of time, but briefly, I'd like to know, what is it that you enjoy or find most rewarding about this work? Because it seems to me that when you go to a party or something and tell people what you do, it really does fall in line with potentially saving the planet. So what do you find most rewarding about working on this?
Well, in addition to the idea that I could be helping to save a population of suffering a major disaster sometime in the future, it is the interaction with the community. There are truly a number of very dedicated individuals around the country and around the world who spend their time searching the skies for these objects to do the intricate work of detecting and tracking and sending that information into our Minor Planet Center to make it available to the community for analysis, determination of orbits, predicting things ahead. And they're sort of an unsung army, so to speak, that is doing the hard work today to save the world, literally, from a disaster that could happen sometime in the future.
Well, Lindley Johnson, director of the Planetary Defense Coordination Office for NASA HQ in Washington, D.C., thanks for joining us. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thanks to Lindley Johnson from NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. Next, we're going to talk to orbital mechanics expert Paul Chodas from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. He specializes in the complex calculations used to determine the threat posed by near-Earth objects. Paul Chodas, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's a real pleasure to have you because I've been an admirer of your career for many years. I'd like to start out with you telling us, just give us a really basic primer on the size and composition of asteroids that we would find near Earth.
Well, they come in all sizes, and the ones that come near the Earth are discoverable even at very small sizes. So in our catalog, we have over 17,000 near-Earth objects, and some of them are really small, just a few meters in size. But we can see those because they get close to the Earth. And they run all the way up to tens of kilometers in size, 30-ish kilometers in size for the very biggest near-Earth asteroids.
And those are the ones we certainly would not want impacting the Earth.
Absolutely not. And believe me, we know of all of those ones, the really large ones, because they're very easy to detect, and they are far away and well removed from the orbit of the Earth. The threshold we have used over the last 20 years is 1 kilometer in size. So 20 years ago, we were assigned the task of finding 90% of the near-Earth asteroids that are 1 kilometer and larger.
And where are we on that goal?
And we are, we believe we're about 95% complete on that. So our catalog, so we've pretty well found all of the ones that are 1 kilometer and larger. And those are the ones that are large enough that would cause a global catastrophe, and that would have the potential for changing the climate and being a very globally serious impact. So that was our first priority. And as I say, we're at about 95%. We're still finding a few. There are, we think, around 940 in the total population. So we're at 95% of that, more or less.
Well, I'd like to talk about your expertise, because it's just mind-bogglingly amazing. You calculate the orbits, and you design the software that figures out the whether these objects have the capability of impacting the Earth. Could you just tell us a little bit about how that capability of you using mathematics and software and physics has evolved, say, since the early 1990s with the impact of Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9? Because as I recall, you were the one that calculated that orbit was going to impact Jupiter, right?
I was indeed, yeah. That's when we first started putting the calculation of impact probability in the software. I was doing this in the mid-90s. We have a larger team now that have perfected the software and automated it a lot. So, my hat's off to all of the folks who came after me to improve the software. But the basic idea is to take the measurements of the positions of each asteroid. And the positions are just on the sky, so they're just like latitude, longitude on the sky. And over time, you have you keep tracking these. You make a note of where the asteroid was at what time, and you accumulate a big file of all of these measurements, and you can determine its three-dimensional orbit from that. That's step one. But then you need to understand that there's uncertainty in those measurements. As there are in all measurements. And so even though they're tiny little uncertainties on the order of an arc second or half an arc second or so, and you have to factor in a calculation of how accurate is your orbit knowledge. And then you run the accuracy forward in time as well. And that's where the impact probability comes in, because you can only predict an asteroid's position to within a range of possibilities, let's say 20 or 30 years from now. And the question is whether that range of possibilities includes the Earth or not. And generally, of course, it does not include the Earth. But in a few cases, when that range is very wide, it could cross the Earth. And that's where we get a possibility of an impact. Now, all of our impact probabilities, we have over 700 of them at last count, are public and online, and we publish all of this data. They're all very small numbers, on the order of 1 in 1,000 or even less, and the vast majority of them are for really small objects, small enough that would burn up in the atmosphere. So that's reassuring.
And that's it. It's through the Center for Near-Earth Object Studies at JPL, right?
That's right. Yes, that's our group, and I'm the manager of that group, being the senior member of it.
What you know, you talked a little bit about the software and that's evolved over the years since the 90s to now, but what kind of hardware do you need to make these calculations? Is it, do you need a supercomputer or just a laptop or what?
No, they run on Linux workstations, and this can be done, if it's done smartly, it can be done fairly quickly. Now, when we find an orbit that is hazardous and it might cross the Earth's orbit, then we will do a special analysis, which could take, you know, a few hours of detailed probing of possible variations of the orbit, that, and then we investigate whether those variations could come near the Earth. So you know, that's a bit of a technicality, but that's you know, the basic technique. It's not compute intensive particularly, but you do have to have very precise models of the forces that are acting on asteroids. And fortunately, these forces are predictable, they're modelable, they're mostly gravity. And you have to account for the gravity of all of the objects that could, all the planets and satellites that could perturb the asteroid's orbit, and then keep track of all of that for 100 years into the future.
When did you first get interested in computing orbits?
At an early age, elementary school, in fact. I'm sure I was fascinated by science fiction stories about orbits where the, you know, the protagonist in a science fiction story would be able to calculate where an asteroid would be, let's say, you know, 6 months from now, and was understood orbits well enough to be able to perturb the orbit or even bring it back to the Earth, which is you know, which is kind of getting into the area of manipulating asteroid orbits. And that was what the asteroid redirect mission was all about, actually. It was these were science fiction stories in the 60s.
So yeah, I'm thinking about you today working. You must work with lots of young graduate students, right?
We do. Yep. Mm-hmm. It's great to have a team of very talented people in our center who can attack the problems such as automating this process, because more and more asteroids are coming, are being discovered. 2,000 per year is the current discovery rate for near-Earth asteroids. So all of this has to be automated so that we can keep up. And we've kind of trained our software to, first of all, publish everything on our web pages, and secondly, notify us when there's something that is worth, that is noteworthy, a really close approach, or in the future a predicted close approach, or a hazardous prediction on an impact probability, that sort of thing. So it's a fine-tuned system that we continue to work on and improve, that is necessary to keep up with the discovery rate of 2,000 per year means that there are several asteroids discovered every night.
So I like to imagine you going out with those graduate students for a beer after work and telling them stories like, when I was your age, I used to use a slide rule and an abacus to figure out these orbits.
Not quite, but yeah, that's a bit, compared to what things were like back in those days, yeah, that's exactly right. It was rather primitive, and computers were much slower, of course, in those days, but we were just doing one item at a time. Shoemaker-Levy 9 was one example of one object at a time, although 21 fragments of that object, but keeping track of it, just a few objects at a time, and the total number of near-Earth asteroids was very small back then, just a couple thousand, but over time, it's great to have a good team, and it's a fun project also to work on, and a great team to that provides really a great website and continually improved methods of computing these orbits.
Well, we'll be sure and put a link to the website. But before we go, on a lighter note, one of the things that I found really fascinating that you did was there was an object orbiting the sun that was mysterious, and you were the one that figured out what it was. And you know what I'm talking about, right?
I think I do. Back in 2002, an object was discovered essentially orbiting the Earth. I believe that's the one you're talking about.
Yeah.
And it was a very distant orbit. It was actually farther than the moon, but it was a moving object, and that's how asteroids are discovered, as a point of light moving on the sky. And this one was orbiting the Earth, so it was not given an asteroid designation, but we didn't know what kind of spacecraft would be way out there, and it didn't match up with any known spacecraft. But as we tracked it over the weeks and months, we got a better and better orbit, and we were able to predict it farther back in time. And I was able to statistically show that this was probably the third stage from the the Apollo 12 launch. So that would be the S4B third stage from Apollo 12, which was designed to go into orbit around the sun. It was targeted to miss the moon as it left the Earth and swing by the moon and go into orbit around the sun. But there was some failure which left it kind of orbiting the Earth in this loose, very distant orbit. And I was able to show that it had orbited the Earth for a few times and then escaped, and for 30 years was floating in an orbit around the sun, but then came back in 2002 and was recaptured by the Earth's gravity and into a similar orbit, a distant orbit around the Earth. And so that was a great mystery story that I think I had solved. It was the long-lost third stage from Apollo 12.
Yeah, I thought that was a cool story. The rocket that took Pete Conrad and Al Bean and Dick Gordon to the moon and got hit by lightning, as I recall, when it was launched in November of 1969. That was an amazing story.
I remember, of course, being older, I remember the launch and the whole story, and they burnt out TV camera, which is a big disappointment. So I had been following it very closely, so I remember that. I got to meet some of the astronauts as well. So it's kind of fun to be able to contribute to that that story.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. And, if nothing else, it led to Al Bean's art career.
Yep. Yeah, Al Bean. Yeah, I have Al Bean's book, and I did meet Al Bean. Yeah, it's great. He's a Renaissance man.
He felt bad about the camera not working, so he painted what it looked like and his impressions of it over all these years. Beautiful paintings. So anyway, we're about out of time, but I really appreciate you talking to us, Paul. It was really, really fascinating to hear about what it takes to calculate these orbits, and I'm so glad that somebody like you is doing that.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll talk to Megan Bruck-Sayal, a physicist intimately involved in the plans to deflect an asteroid from a collision with Earth. Stay with us. And we're back. Our next guest is Megan Bruck-Sayal from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. She's a physicist involved in HAMMER, Hypervelocity Asteroid Mitigation Mission for Emergency Response, which is a way to actually change the course of a potentially hazardous asteroid. Megan, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you.
So you recently were a co-author, I believe, for a piece published in the journal Acta Astronautica, right?
Yes, that's right.
And you are interested, you're a physicist, interested in trying to prevent an asteroid from striking the Earth. And I love the way people in science always find a way to create acronym names. And this one's a good one, because Hypervelocity Asteroid Mitigation Mission for Emergency Response is HAMMER, right?
Right, yep.
And I, as I recall, there's a science fiction novel, I think by Larry Niven, that was called Lucifer's Hammer, which was kind of about a scenario of an asteroid or a comet hitting the Earth.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I've had people refer to that, and I have not read it myself, but I've heard a lot about it.
I just found it ironic when I saw the name. Well, let's talk about, first of all, what was the impetus for coming up with this study?
We've entered into an interagency agreement between the national laboratories that the National Nuclear Security Agency runs, Lawrence Livermore and Los Alamos in particular. Us with NASA have started working together these last few years about how to plan for an event where we would want to deflect an asteroid. And as part of this interagency agreement, we have been working on a series of case studies, doing end-to-end analysis of okay, if you have a particular object threatening the Earth, what would we do, and in what timetables would we need to act to successfully deflect or disrupt the object? So this was the first case study of those three case studies, where we focused on asteroid Bennu. And Bennu is a particularly well-described asteroid. It's a near-Earth asteroid that does a close pass of the Earth every 6 years. And so we have a lot of radar observations and other wavelength observations of the asteroid, know quite a bit about it. And the OSIRIS-REx mission is en route to Bennu at this moment. It's arriving in August 2018. So we will have even more information on this asteroid within the coming years.
And my understanding is that there is a small chance that this asteroid could collide with Earth, and the date is September 25th, 2135?
Yes, that's one of a few different close approaches, very close approaches that Bennu is scheduled to have over the next couple hundred years. I think the cumulative chance that it might impact the Earth is still very small, though. It's something like 1 in 2,700, so we don't have to lose sleep about it necessarily.
But it is worth doing a study about, as you say, because of all of the types of natural disasters, an asteroid impact with Earth ranks up there right at the top for the disruption that could cause to, you know, not only our civilization, but life on Earth.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it could, but depending where it hits, it could kill millions of people.
And let's talk a little bit about the actual, the spacecraft, the Hammer spacecraft, this mission. It has two different ways of possibly dealing with this, as I understand. One is by nudging the asteroid out of its orbit, like just kinetically moving it. And you only have to move an asteroid, as I understand it, a little bit. And over a long period of time, that adds up, and you can deflect it that way as long as you do it soon enough, right?
Mm-hmm. You have to have a good amount of warning time, and you need, the larger the asteroid is, the more warning time you need. So Bennu is a pretty good size. It's about 500 meters across, which can present some difficulty in getting that moved in time.
And then the other scenario would be actually delivering some kind of nuclear payload. That's where Lawrence Livermore and Los Alamos come in. So could you describe those two different methods to us, and, you know, what the two different scenarios are there?
Sure. And just to clear up a common misconception, when we talk about nuclear deflection, it's still just a nudge when we're using it in deflection mode, as we would for something a Bennu size. So you can use a kinetic impactor, which just crashes a spacecraft into the asteroid and changes its momentum kinetically. But you could also use a nuclear device to nudge the asteroid by using it in standoff mode. So you detonate the device some distance away from the surface of the asteroid, and X-rays and neutrons are deposited in the surface of that asteroid, vaporize material, and blow off of it. And that just from conservation of momentum, you're imparting a gentle nudge to the asteroid in the opposite direction from where as the material vaporizes and comes off the asteroid's surface. So the end effect is hopefully similar between the nuclear deflection and the kinetic deflection. The benefit of the nuclear is that it's much more mass efficient. You can deliver a lot more of a momentum change for a given mass, for a given payload, using the nuclear approach than you can using the kinetic approach.
And so to kind of make things clear, it's nothing like what people saw in the movie Armageddon.
That's right. Yeah. And there are cases where you might want to blow it up into a lot of little pieces and robustly disperse those fragments. And we would refer to that as a nuclear disruption rather than a nuclear deflection. And that would be saved for shorter warning time scenarios where there's not enough time to deflect it. You could still try to disrupt it very robustly and make sure it's fragmented into tiny pieces and those are all well dispersed.
So where are we at right now, would you say, in terms of this? This is a preliminary study, as I understand it, but say if we were to find out that there was an object going to hit the Earth within 10 years, what would we do? What would unfold to be able to try to deal with that?
Well, the sooner we could act, the better chance we have to deflect it. And one of the most challenging pieces is the evolving probabilities of impact associated with these objects. So the first few observations you have of it, you might not have its trajectory totally well characterized. And so the probability of impact might be smaller, like 1 to 10%. And it's only with more observations that you realize, oh, the probability of impact either goes to zero or it goes to closer to 100%. And so initially, a lot more time and energy towards observations of a threatening object would be directed towards it. And then the policymakers have to decide what options they would like to pursue. And if you act early enough, a kinetic impactor can often be sufficient depending on its size. As long as it's like a couple hundred meters or smaller, it's possible. Once it gets to be Bennu's size, however, 500 meters, it's very hard to accomplish a deflection kinetically. And that's what we saw in our study, for example, that even with 10 or 25 years of warning time, you would need dozens and dozens of launches of hammer spacecraft-sized impactors to successfully deflect it. And so if you wanted to be successful with one launch, you could do it with a nuclear device. But it ultimately will rest with the decision makers of the spacefaring nations to make that call, which approach they would like to take.
Well, I saw that there are three agencies involved in this: NASA, of course, and the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, where you are, and then also Los Alamos National Laboratory. Could you describe for us like the roles that each three play?
Sure. So NASA is responsible for discovery of near-Earth asteroids and all the observational pieces of the puzzle. The labs perform important functions in simulating deflection and disruption. Now, the other universities and laboratories worldwide also do some simulation of deflection and disruption, but the labs have the expertise in nuclear explosion simulation as well, so that's where we can really contribute a lot. But I think it's particularly powerful to use the same codes to model both approaches, both the kinetic impact and nuclear deflection. So we use the same simulation tools to model both deflection tactics. And Los Alamos is a sister lab of Livermore. The two labs serve as it's a great way to validate and benchmark our own simulations against each other, because we use slightly different simulation tools. And so it's nice to have both labs doing comparative simulations of these types of problems.
What was like one of the most challenging things for you working on this? What was one of the most difficult hurdles to overcome?
I think it's always challenging to try to model exactly the same problem in using two different tools. So our collaborators at Los Alamos were simulating the same problem as we were, but when you use different codes, there's just different methodologies and baked into each of those codes. And so trying to make sure we get the best comparisons possible between our different approaches was challenging, but I think we did. It ended up being a really great opportunity to learn more about our own approaches and our collaborators' approaches during that process.
And what was like the most rewarding or even fun aspect of working on this?
I think the most rewarding aspect is getting to interface with our NASA collaborators on how to design the spacecraft. So there's this whole mission design lab at Goddard Space Flight Center where a bunch of folks from all the different sites got together and talked about what kind of spacecraft they would build. And I didn't get to participate in that part of the project. I was on maternity leave at the time, but that was really neat. And it was really neat to see what came out of those discussions. Dave Dearborn from Livermore attended that and contributed a lot to those discussions. And then seeing what were the different trajectory solutions found by Goddard. So Brent Barbie at Goddard was responsible for looking at all the different launch opportunities necessary if you wanted to deflect it kinetically with Hammer, and then finding that there's so many dozens of impacts necessary from Hammer to successfully deflect it was really interesting. And it just really showcased how important it is to have the whole range of tools available to deflect these asteroids, because some of them, like Bennu, are just so big that to do it kinetically, it's very, very difficult.
And then finally, what do you think is the biggest misconception that that people have about work like this, work that people like you do at a laboratory like that, not just about this particular project, but physicists working at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory?
Maybe the biggest misconception is that it's scientists working in a room by themselves for this type of work. It's a lot of teamwork, a lot of a communication necessary between experts in different areas and making sure we're meeting with each other and all on the same page and solving these problems together. So it's very social work in that respect, because you can't, it's too big of a problem for one person to tackle all by themselves. You really need experts from a wide array of backgrounds all working on a piece of the problem together.
And what are the next steps that are going to be involved in this project?
So we have cases 2 and 3 that we've been working on. The second case is focused on the target of a different mission. It's an asteroid called Didymos, which is a binary asteroid. And there's a mission called AIDA, or the U.S. portion of it is called DART. DART is a spacecraft that will impact the smaller of the two asteroids in that binary system, and which is only about 150 meters across. And the genius of this target is that because it's a binary, and when you impact it, you can detect with very good accuracy how much you've deflected it by just by observing the change in period of the binary. And so we don't even necessarily need an observer spacecraft to be there on site to determine how effective the deflection was. you can determine it from Earth-based telescopes. However, ideally, we will also have a European spacecraft there as well, observing up close and giving us even better information about how the deflection goes. So for the second case, we're modeling that deflection, the deflection of the smaller component of the Didymos binary system. For the third case, it's the target of the Rosetta mission of a few years ago. Rosetta was sent to comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko, and it was there for a couple of years observing this comet up close, deploying a lander, really changing our understanding of comets in incredible ways. But it's a very interesting shape, and so we're using that shape model. Some folks have compared it to a rubber ducky shape. We're using a scaled-down version of that, so about 200 meters long, which is quite a bit smaller than the real comet, to look at shape effects on deflection, both nuclear and kinetic deflection. So we're currently working on both of those scenarios, and they should be very interesting.
Well, thanks for joining us today, and we'll look forward to hearing the next steps in this and hope that you don't have to use any of this anytime soon.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks to our guests, Lindley Johnson from NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C., Paul Chodas from the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, and Megan Bruxell from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And thank you for listening. Check out this and past episodes at our website, mynspr.org, and subscribe to Blue Dot at NPR Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Shlom. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz, along with a little help from Aerosmith this time. Our producer and engineer is the man on the board, Nolan Ford. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.
I could stay awake just to hear you breathing. Watch you smile while you are sleeping. While you're far away dreaming, I could spend my life in this sweet surrender. I could stay lost.